Hi, my name is Con Koutsikas and this is A Cuppa with a Conversationalist, an entertaining, educational and informative program with a broad array of guests with unique perspectives and experiences. And for more information about my coaching and workshops, visit my website at www.conkoutsikas.com. Welcome to another episode of A Cuppa with a Conversationalist. My name is Con and I am the conversationalist. And yes, you know it, I have my latte in tow. My guest this morning is Sarah Ryman. How are you this morning, Sarah?
Good, thanks, Con. Thanks for having me on.
Fantastic. Absolute pleasure. Do you have a beverage in tow or not?
I have already had my coffee, but I've only got water.
So. That's okay. We'll forgive you. Thank you. Sarah is a certified business advisor, financial expert, and a professional speaker, providing consulting and training to business owners and teaches them how to understand the story behind their numbers. Sarah is a qualified accountant with 15 years' experience in the tax accounting industry, and she's been a business owner since 2006. But of course, what we're going to talk about today is Sarah's story of where and how it all began. Sarah is a motivational speaker and has an inspiring story of overcoming domestic violence, depression, divorce, and drug abuse, and how changing the way we think can change our lives dramatically. Sarah, you and I met not that many years ago, but probably about 6 years ago, I'd guess. Yeah. And you were certainly looking at embarking on a professional speaking career at that time. Your story is I've actually not heard the whole story, and I know whilst I don't want to dwell, this isn't about dwelling on domestic violence and that side of things, but it's important from how you got to where you are. So if you would be so good, tell us how this all began and how you ended up in that situation.
Yeah, thanks, Con. Yeah. So I grew up in a pretty normal house, I suppose. It was a Christian home. Mum and Dad took us to church every Sunday. Mum and Dad are still together to this day in their 80s. And whilst every family has its own dynamics, good or bad, I'd say it was fairly normal. But when I got sort of to my teenage years, I decided that I didn't like school, didn't like parents. I know this is a shock to anyone that's been a teenager. And so I just wanted to do my own thing. I got to about 15 or 16 and I thought, well, don't like school. I actually dropped out of school in year 10, didn't even finish school, hated it. And Mum and Dad kind of were trying to encourage me not to go down the path of being a high school dropout, but that's what I wanted to do. And like you do, you go get a job in a supermarket. That didn't last too long. But when I was 16, I also moved out of home and unfortunately got caught up in a relationship with a man that was a lot older than me. He was an alcoholic, a drug abuser, and there was a whole lot of, as you can imagine, untoward things going on in the house that we lived in. And when you're in that sort of drug and alcohol scene, it attracts a lot of untoward people as well in your world. So I just rebelled, basically. Didn't want parents or school telling me what to do, but obviously that got me in a whole lot of trouble. And I got caught up, and he was, you know, emotionally and physically violent on occasions. For about 4 years, it was 4 years that I got trapped in that environment, unfortunately. So it wasn't until I was 20 that I kind of got to the end of myself, if we can call it that, and decided that, you know, there had to be a better way to live. I mean, I'd come from a nice, fairly comfortable home. I knew that there was a better way to live. And so I, at 20, my mum and dad helped me move out of the house I was in, came and got all my things in their van because mum and dad were business owners, had a shop. And so they had a van and we removed all of my belongings while my ex-boyfriend was at work. And I decided I'd get in my car and drive to Melbourne and escape the lifestyle here in Adelaide. And I'd never been to Melbourne in my life. It was my 20th birthday, which was only 10 years ago. It might be a shock that I'm over 40, but yes, sorry. And Yeah, and I just had never been to Melbourne, just drove there, found a job, found somewhere to live, like in a cabin park, caravan park, and stayed there for 6 months and just escaped all the people and lifestyle that was here and started to rebuild my life and my mind, I suppose, as well. So,
did you have any issues with him pursuing you afterwards out of interest?
Yeah, he did try to pursue me. And during those 6 months, he obviously contacted my family and things like that. And, of course, they didn't tell him where I was. And then when I did finally come back to Adelaide, I think he did sort of try and catch up with me, but then he realised that it wasn't worth pursuing. And so it didn't really eventuate to anything.
Did you have – did you were there for 4 years and you got to the point, and I kind of use a term sick and tired of being sick and tired, and – there's time for action. Did you have help along the way, or was it just, you know, any women's associations or shelters or anything like that? Or was it just a decision that you made and you said, hey, this is enough? I guess the advantage that you had, clearly you had the support of your family still.
Yeah, no, I didn't have any other support. Yeah, I had my family, mum and dad. No, because back then, because it was 1995, and back then, I guess if we think about today, there wasn't as much support around there that time in terms of things like mental health, or I'm sure there was some sort of help, but I didn't reach out for any of it. I guess some of the people around me, like friends and stuff, were saying to me, you know, Sarah, you need to get out of this situation. Okay. This is not good for you. This person is going to really hurt you. And so a lot of people were trying to taught me out of it, but no, I didn't have any other sort of, it was just a decision that I didn't want to live my life like that anymore.
Yeah. And I guess getting mixed up in that scene at 16, obviously the younger we are, the more impressionable we are, I'd suggest you're probably one of the lucky ones that at getting involved at 16 and actually dragging yourself out when you were 20, I'd suggest you'd be, it would be a rarity.
Yeah, and that's the thing, looking back, although it's not great to have gone through that, it actually has taught me resilience. And from that time on, I've looked at life, you know, and kind of compared it to back then, like, is this situation I'm in now as bad as back then? And basically most of the time the answer is no, it couldn't be. So, you know, it's like kind of get over it in some ways if I'm going to be harsh. But, I wouldn't wish that upon anyone, but it's a great experience because you get to see what how other people do live and that it's going on in society all around us. And we, you know, most of us have got a great sort of life that we live in Australia, and we should be so grateful, but there is another side of life where, you know, it's not a wonderful life, that's for sure.
Moving forward, obviously in your introduction, you've a tax accountant, and we were joking about tax accountants before we started to record. Absolutely no offense to any tax accountants that are listening. I know some tax accountants and they're very, very nice people. What made you pick accounting? How were you guided into that?
Well, I guess once I got to 20 and then I sort of lived in Melbourne and I didn't have an education, so I only worked in hospitality and bakeries, cafes, etc. And then by the time I was sort of 22, I'd met my first husband, and by 24, I'd have my first child. So when I was 23, I kind of thought, right, I'm pregnant now, I'm married, I probably should go back to school and train because I just didn't want to be in hospitality my whole life. I picked account because I was really good at maths. Believe it or not, I was actually a really good straight A student before I dropped out. And I was in advanced maths classes and used to get straight A's. So it was kind of and I said to mum and dad, what do you think I should do? And they said, well, you're really good at maths. Dad always used to sit down at the kitchen table with me helping with maths homework. So that was kind of the natural progression, I suppose. So, I actually picked accounting. It didn't pick me. I was that silly.
That's funny. That's very funny.
So I just enrolled in TAFE, tertiary education, and started my advanced diploma in accounting when I was 23. I didn't finish that all my uni. I went on to uni as well until I was about 30 because I then had my second daughter at sort of 25, 26. So I did all my study when my children were quite young.
And you've gone from tax accountant. Now I'm going to suggest what you're doing, whilst it's quite different in the way that you do it, where did you come up with, I guess, the decision, or how did you get guided or led into what you're doing now? And I know you do a lot of speaking engagements. Your story is indeed motivational. I also know that you're running programs and teaching business owners and a whole heap. So how did you transition out of being being a tax accountant into that?
Yeah, so as I said in the intro, 2006, I got a job, went into a partnership in a small firm in Adelaide, and then proceeded to sort of own my own business. And then I met my sort of second husband, and he's actually a tax accountant as well. So we went into partnership together, and I did that for about 15 years, and I did like it, but I just got to the point where the work, it wasn't the clients that became boring, it was the work that became boring. Okay. And everyone has something to do with tax in Australia. Like, if you've got a business, you've got something to do with tax. Filing a tax return, doing BAS statements, all the GST and all that sort of stuff, that's what I really got sick of. Mm. And it wasn't until about 2017 that I said to my husband, because we were partners in our firm, you know, and we had a whole lot of clients, I said, look, I'm getting really bored and frustrated. I was basically at the end of myself. I just thought, I don't want to do this. And it was, you know, the 40-year-old kind of midlife crisis, if you can call it that. I'm sure everyone's been at that point. It's like, I sat there one day and I went, okay, do I want to do this for another 25 years? And the question resoundingly was just no. And we had a business coach, a business mentor in our accounting firm back then. And she was probably one of the catalysts for it, although it was on my mind. And she just said to me, Sarah, why are you still doing this work? She was quite harsh about it. She was more of a sledgehammer than, you know, sugarcoating, that's for sure.
Velvet sledgehammer.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. She goes, I don't know why you're still doing this. You want to be something else. You want to be a speaker. You want to be a consultant. And I'm like, but it's too, you know, I've got all these clients and this is my business and we're partners and that. And she said, but your husband Peter is going to 100% support it. That's not the problem, is it? No, that's not the problem. She goes, well, why are you still doing it? Stop it. You're not a tree. Move. And I'm like, okay. And she was dead right. She was totally dead right. And I got to the point, because I really didn't like the work for probably 3 to 5 years leading up to that. I sat there doing it because I kind of had to. So that was kind of the turning point. And then somehow I got this crazy idea in my mind that I was going to be a speaker. And I couldn't get that thought out of them. And now, whether you believe in divine intervention, God, the universe, whatever. I believe that, you know, God specifically told me you've got to be, and it just kept a resounding, this like this whirlwind in my mind, you've got to be a speaker, you're going to be a speaker. And I knew nothing about speaking. I knew absolutely nothing. Plus, I was scared of it too. And I think that's probably how we met too, Connor, as I came along to one of your speaking training sessions. That might have been 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I did. I just joined a couple of courses. I joined PSA, the Professional Speakers, and just started to learn about the business of speaking, which is only one element to what I do in business.
Of course.
But that's how it started. Yeah.
We mentioned in your introduction consulting and training business owners and teaching them how to understand the story behind their numbers. What are there common specific problems, regular things that you see in this area?
Yeah, definitely. And again, it's one of the reasons why I left tax accounting, because the clients I was dealing with were coming to me with far greater problems than, you know, a tax return. Let's leave that to the accountants to do. They can do that stuff. But they had cash flow issues. They had staffing issues. They had I'm working too many hours issues. And I knew that I couldn't consult to them or coach them or advise them whilst I was still caught up doing tax. This wasn't enough time. It wasn't enough time. These days I do, more of a sort of a CFO work, like a chief financial officer work, not a full time. I've got a couple of clients, well, I've got four actually that I do it for, and I go in there every week or fortnight and help them with the financial controls. But it's more than that. It's really, you know, coaching business owners to get to the point where they can systemize and process their business enough so they can go away for a week or two and it doesn't fall down around them. But also there's themes around lots of business owners, as we know, get into business because they're great at what they do. So a carpenter or a tradie or whatever, they'll get into business because they can make more money doing it on their own, for one, but because they, you know, they're really good at what they do, but they don't necessarily understand the skill of business or finance. So even just sitting down with people every month, some smaller businesses, and going through a profit loss or a cash flow and showing them where their money's coming from and going to is a valuable exercise because it helps with decision-making too. So that is a big theme. Many people don't in business don't understand where their money's going to or coming from, or even if they're making a profit, which may be surprising, but lots don't.
Yeah, no, it's not surprising because, excuse me, we've definitely got this frog in the throat. No, I don't have COVID for anybody who's wondering. Sarah, what I find interesting and people not understanding their numbers, and I can certainly relate to that. My first business in my mid-20s was an absolute catastrophe, to really sum it up. And it was through lack of understanding of numbers, and a big believer, a big follower of Kerwin Ray. And Kerwin said, you can't manage what you don't track.
Yeah.
And, or in other words, you can't manage what you don't understand if you're not understanding it. And from my perspective, I didn't understand it. All I saw was sales, and sales equated to money that, you know, you could spend without really being conscious of many of the other things, other than your, obviously your major expenses, rent, and your purchasing of your goods. That said, it's really an education process for the businesses. So are they coming to you at a stage where it's, holy goodness, I'm in deep trouble here, or are they coming to you because they're going, right, I need to be proactive in my education to understand my numbers?
It's a bit of both, to be honest. I have dealt with a few businesses that are in trouble, like in terms of we're not making money, we don't know where it's going, we're making losses, we need to understand where it's going. A lot of that sort of consulting is fairly short-lived, I'd say, you know, because there's not a lot you can do until they kind of turn things around. You can say to them, look, these are the problems, your wages or rent's too high, or you're not making enough sales, those type of things. But mainly the most of the business I work with now are looking to better themselves. They're looking to, like, for instance, only this last week I got a new client and they've gone from virtually zero to 2 million turnover in about 2 years.
Wow.
And they don't have business acumen. They're great at what they do and got a whole lot of contracts from some big companies, but they can't grow anymore until they start to understand numbers and cash flow and finances and where do we best invest our money? Can we hire someone? Can we buy a commercial property? You know, those type of questions are only answered through knowing what your numbers and measuring what you're doing. And they're just doing on the tools, working. There's no strategic planning. There's no goal setting. Most of it is that sort of stuff. Yeah.
And I would suggest with some of the businesses that might come to you, there'd be a fair bit of denial, head in the sand thinking, if I don't know about it, it can't hurt me.
Yeah, there is a bit of that too. So you have to, in some ways, I've got to pick and choose who I work with too, because lots of businesses can turn things around. But as you know, Con, if we just work with who's your client or anyone, well, if you don't define who your target market is, if I don't work with people that really want to change what and are prepared to put in the work, because the reality is I can't go in there and do the work for them. I can only advise them and steer them in the right direction and give them some tools to use. But at the end of the day, they've got to implement. And if you're not working with people that really want to implement, that makes it difficult too. Yeah.
They need to be sick and tired of being sick and tired as well.
Yep, they do.
So talking of the strategies that you're helping businesses to bring some value to the audience, what sort of strategies are you suggesting or implementing? What are some of the key strategies?
Well, most of them I do, we do strategic planning like every year or even every 6 months. And if for the audience that doesn't know what that is, it's just things looking at strengths and weaknesses in a business, doing some goal planning and goal setting, so identifying what the problems are in the business, what the bottlenecks are. I mean, I'll give you an example. I recently conducted one with a business and I sent a survey out to all the staff asking them a number of questions. And one of the questions was to the staff, do you understand what the vision and mission of the business is? And unfortunately, right?
Yeah, I'm waiting for this one.
Yeah, most of them came back and said yes to churn out work and get as many jobs out the door as possible on time. So this is a homeware, we'll call it a manufacturing business, so I don't think about too much.
Yeah.
So they're on, there's a factory floor, they're making things. And I said to the owner, this is probably not because that's what he's doing. He's getting in there going, we're behind time, the client's not getting in, can we churn out some more jobs? Can we get, and he's made a successful business, but we need to get staff on board with, hey, is it quality customer service? Is it a quality product? Are we here to serve Adelaide? There was no definition of what their vision and mission is. So I work with them a lot on those type of things, because whilst that stuff can be a bit fluffy, it certainly translates into better outcomes financially and for staff, for any business owner. I've seen it. So it's that sort of thing. It's, again, a lot of business owners don't even have a budget in place, like a simple 12-month cash flow or budget, and just working on strategies. Well, if you want to buy a commercial factory, like let's say that's a goal for a manufacturer, if you want to buy that, well, then how do we get to that point? How do we get to saving up or getting a loan for $2 million to buy that? And most of them have these ideas, but they're not they're not concrete. They're not, there's no way to actually every day implement the steps to get to that point, because you can't just go get a $2 million factory if you don't have the funds or you don't,
of course,
have a plan.
With, you mentioned goal setting, and it's always something that's been fascinating to me. I was never exposed to goal setting until I got involved in personal and professional development probably 10, 12 years ago. How many, and I know the impact that it has, it's just dramatic, and we won't go into it now, but there's a whole heap of science behind it, apart from just knowing where you're going to go. How many business owners do you come across that come to you that actually don't have goals in place?
Bigger ones do. If we're thinking about bigger in terms of if they've got sort of, more than maybe 20 staff or something,
right,
like
okay.
10 to $20 million business, we talk about that. Most of business that are under sort of 5 million, if we call them the small micro, they don't have any.
Mm.
And again, that's probably a reason why they hire me too, is just to wrap some accountability around it. So I might use some project management tools with them, like Trello or Asana, if you know what those are, to track what they're doing, because they've generally got all of the ideas in their head, but they're not on paper or they're not written down anywhere. So they basically just don't get done, and they want me to come in every month, or not just to go through figures, but to go, okay, what did you do last month? What actions or steps did you take to get further towards that goal? We said you were going to do this. Did you do it? And if they don't, well, they get a gentle kick up the bum, so to speak.
Gentle.
Yeah.
Yeah. With one of the things that I've found personally, and many business owners that I speak to as well, is this, they're so busy, whether they're successful or they're struggling to meet their objectives, and switching off is a real problem. They're working at work till 7-8 o'clock. They go home, they're working till late. Their relationships are having some challenges. They say, I'm spending time with the kids, but the kids are playing, watching television, and they're on their laptops. So they're not really present. They're just what I call supervising rather than being with them. Do you help them with me time is just so important. It's a bit like, you know, filling your cup, because if you've got an empty cup, you can't really pour in anyone else's. Do you help them with strategies on how they can switch off from work and they can actually get some downtime to regenerate, to recoup, to get a little bit of clarity in what they're doing?
Yeah, whilst it's not my area of expertise, because I'm not a life coach or anything like that, it's certainly an area that, again, when we use these project management tools or goal setting, it's definitely an area that I put in there on self-care. And even some of my training I've done in the past, I've got a whole module on mindset and self-care. Because, yeah, again, it's you're right, and especially people that are kind of in their 30s and 40s as well, and they've got probably got kids or teenagers or kids, and they're trying to run a business. A lot of them barely even sleep. You know, these guys I started working with last week. One of them's got five kids. He's 40, and they're working 70 to 80 hours a week. And, you've got to be deliberate. You've got to put time aside. And it's just like the working on instead of in. When I start working with people, I go, if you want this to work, you've got to put aside at least 2 hours a week to work on the things that I'm giving you to do. But you've also got to schedule in like holidays during the year. Not everyone takes the advice. It's the old lead the horse to water.
Yep.
But I always encourage people to, at the beginning of any year, schedule in 1 week every quarter or something like that, or 2 weeks in the middle of the year, so that you know that you've got something to look forward to, one, and that you're going to get that downtime. But yeah, it's definitely a challenge for a lot of, and many business owners like to micromanage too and find it hard to delegate.
Because they're the only ones that can do it.
That's right. So that's a big area. I really focus a lot too on delegating. But again, delegating comes back to having the right procedures and processes and systems in place so that your staff can do it the right way. And if you don't invest in time in putting those in place, then you're going to have problems with delegation and good staff too. So it's quite, it's a minefield, isn't it? Business owners can't be good at everything.
it's just not possible.
No.
I said to a mate of mine once, and he is a serious micromanager, like I'm talking to the nth degree.
Oh, gosh.
And I said to him, mate, I'm just curious what's going to happen to this enterprise. And yeah, we're talking, you know, probably, I don't know, upwards of 8, 9, 10 mil. I said, just out of interest, if you get run over by a bus tomorrow, what's going to happen? You know, I said, I can pretty much guarantee you that the place isn't going to collapse. But, you know, you need to be able, or you need to obviously have the procedures, as you said, but you need to give the staff or your team, they need to have some confidence that you're saying, okay, here it is, you go and do it, and we'll work with whatever the consequences are, giving them some parameters on what they can and what they can't do. So that's really important. I'm just curious, just going back to your challenges with regards to domestic violence and so on and so forth, are you finding that as a result of that, and you're speaking, that women predominantly are drawn to you, or are you still seeing, is your demographic still, you know, 50-50 or more males or whatever? What's your thoughts there?
Yeah, no, it's still 50-50 really. Like I've got a number of clients that are men, and they're tradies or manufacturers and stuff like that. So yeah, it is a bit of a mix. I mean, at the moment I'm working with some professional services business women, so women that are specifically in accounting, lawyers, HR, those traditional kind of practices as well, but that's just one element. But yeah, I certainly do have a lot of men as well. They're probably just drawn by the message, or, you know, just wanting to free up time. I mean, one of the taglines I've sort of been using lately is step up as CEO and build a business that's scalable and saleable. And when I say that, I mean, like you're just saying, Cotton, if the business owner drops off the perch tomorrow, then is that business going to keep running? And also, is it saleable? So if we think about a lot of businesses these days that are personal brands, perhaps like you and me, Con, aren't saleable in themselves, but traditional businesses like accounting, legal, even a manufacturing, they're saleable. Mm. They're actually worth something. They're an asset. And most of the time, those business owners have the business is their superannuation as well. It's their retirement funds. And if it's 100% reliant on them, it's not going to be that saleable because no one else can just walk in, take over and start making money from it because it's so reliant on. And that's a big problem as well. Men and women, both I seem to attract,
You just made a really, really interesting point, and it wasn't something that I was going to go down the road of, but if we can just touch on it briefly, you talked about businesses that are saleable and non-saleable. Now, your business is a little bit different to mine. Mm-hmm. You've certainly got, you know, your tax background, and so I'd suggest there's probably more saleability to it. It's not uncommon, as you know, for, you know, whether it's accountants or lawyers to buy books, let's say. People like what I do, and there are lots of us who are what I call solopreneurs, and whilst they may have a support team in the background, whether it's virtual assistants or whatever they may have, is something, whilst you're saying what I do is not saleable because I'm the brand, I'm it, is there something that we can do or a strategy that we can employ on a long term to make that business saleable? And before, and just let me interject one thing just before you answer that question. The other analogy I want to share with you is car dealerships are famous. I drive down Blair Road all the time to go to my chiropractor. Big shout out to Only Chiropractic Clinic. You guys are just the most amazing human beings, and you keep me walking, which is a challenge in itself. I drive past Graham Corns Toyota. Now, for many of you international viewers, you'll have no idea who Graham Corns is, and that doesn't really matter. The point is, he started a car dealership 40 odd years ago when he was playing professional sport, and he sold that name, but he has nothing to do with the business. So can I just sell my name? So now I'll shut up and let you answer the question.
It's actually a really good conversation, because, and what I kind of meant by that was, like, I guess thought leadership, what I'm talking about, and personal brands. When you're like Con, you're the personal brand, you're the thought leader, we're sharing our IP, which is ours, just like I suppose anyone that's an author, speaker, coach, consultant. I figure that those sort of businesses can't actually be sold like a accounting or legal firm. I mean, accounting and legal can, because they've got recurring revenue, like a mortgage broker. They've got books, they've got recurring or rental roles or whatever. But I think when you're a personal brand thought leadership, what the take I have on it is that we probably, the money that we do get, we need to invest in assets like property or shares or whatever you want to do that kind of generate that recurring revenue. That's one take on it. But also, if we think about some of the best thought leaders in the world, like Jim Rohn or John Maxwell, those type of guys, they've built like a brand behind them. So John Maxwell's got the John Maxwell Leadership Training Academy, and they train coaches, and he's hired people to do that. But I think just for us solopreneurs, I don't see a way, like, no one could take over and do what I do because they haven't got the knowledge or background that I've got. I could potentially build a program where I train other coaches with like my IP or something like that. I'm sure that you can do that. And I've seen people do that. For instance, I don't know if you know a guy called Travis Bell, but he's the bucket list guy, right? And he's actually created this whole program around training people on how to live your best life, tick off your bucket list items. And he now sells it kind of like as a franchise, and people buy in as a bucket list coach, and then they train others. And then again, there's things like, I mean, like me, I've got online courses, so I've got recurring sort of passive income that way. But I don't think thought leaders and personal brands in themselves can sell anything, because there's no tangible type stuff to sell, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'll put it in the right way.
No. That makes sense. You're right. And you're right, you know, the likes of Jim Rohn and even Zig Ziglar and people like that who have, you know, been dead for many, many years, their brand is still right up there, and the business continues because of the programs that they've created and the way that they've marketed their IP. Sarah, I just want to touch on one more thing before we wind up, and I'll go back to myself here. You know, I grew up in a family where financial literacy was certainly not something that we spoke about, other than, you know, save, work, save, work, save, work. There was nothing else really attached to it. And I learned my financial literacy the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
And the lessons that I've learned, they're not the lessons that you kind of wish, you know, your kids or family members to go down that road, because, as you know, with your experiences with the people that you work with, it's certainly not pleasant. How do you see financial literacy in and when I say our youth, I'm talking in, you know, late teens, early 20s, because we're seeing this plethora of, you know, Afterpay and, you know, things like that. Even the Commonwealth Bank have got their own version to, you know, God forbid they miss out. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, Con. I mean, I didn't either. My parents are actually terrible at money, and I did learn nothing from them in terms of financial literacy. I learned what not to do as a business owner. So I learned the hard way too. Yeah. And even being an accountant, I didn't get taught financial literacy or how to build wealth. I had to learn my own way, and from like Rich Dad, Poor Dad and Robert Kiyosaki, those sort of things. Mm. Well, I mean, I'm quite passionate about that area, and I've actually developed an online course called Adulting 101, Financial Money Management for Teens, which I'm bringing out pretty soon. Because my kids too are now 20 and 22, my daughters, and I always taught them to save, you know, get into the property market as soon as you can, buy property, it's simple, you can understand it, it's tangible, that sort of thing. And they kind of took that for granted and realised when they were older that all their friends didn't know that stuff and were racking up all these debts on Afterpay and car loans and stuff, and were, you know, working and then running out of money at the end of every week. And my 22-year-old daughter said to me a couple of years ago, "Mum, I don't understand why those people run out of money." I said, "Because they're not taught to save. Well, they weren't taught to invest." But, yeah, definitely Afterpay, ZipPay and access to credit even is probably too easy these days for young people. And if parents aren't taught, or parents are bad with money, and then, God forbid, it's not taught in school, you know, how do they learn? I mean, I think recently just on the Commonwealth Bank, they came out and said that I think it was a state government or a national government thing that said that they were pulling out all of the CommBank financial literacy and training in schools because they didn't want big banks recruiting kids. Okay, now that's fine, we get that. But to pull out the financial literacy or the training on saving, that is a crime. And I don't think they filled it with anything either. And that was after 90 or 100 years that the Commonwealth Bank had been doing those programs. So I think it's a big area that needs more education around, and we need to get into primary schools and start teaching it so that kids don't get to 18, 19, 20 and all of a sudden they've got 20 or 30 grand worth of personal debt.
If not more.
If not more, that's it.
Because you're right, it's pretty easy to get, and this instant gratification aspect, and it's not just, you know, just not for millennials and you know, even many of my generation still suffer from that affliction. Never mind. Sarah, it's been an absolute pleasure, and the work you're doing is extremely valuable, and I wish you all the best with that. It's been a pleasure having you on the program. My name is Con. I am the Conversationalist. And until next time, bye for now. Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of A Cuppa with a Conversationalist. To join in next time, follow or subscribe. And for more information about my coaching and workshops, visit my website at www.conkutsikas.com.